You're listening to Federal Prison Authority Presents Around the Block with Bruce Cameron and Susan Giddings, only on LA Talk Radio.
Well, hello, everybody. Welcome to another exciting episode of Around the Block. I'm Bruce Cameron, along with Susan Giddings. Here we are in November of 2025. The weather is starting to get cold, even here in Texas. Ooh, the landlord forgot to turn the AC off, and it got down to the 30s down here. Ooh. And so...
We're actually going to be in the 20s tonight.
Oh, yeah, you guys.
We got a little snow on the ground.
Yeah.
Just a little bit.
So we're going to talk about today, you know, just want to think we've talked about everything. We haven't. And Susan has, per usual, come up with a menu of things that we have never talked about on this show that are very useful about release procedures and some of the minute details with that and exiting pay and all kinds of fun stuff. So without further ado.
Yes. So we have not talked about those logistics. And you know, looking at the Facebook group, I saw a few questions, some different stuff on like pickup time and transportation and things like that. And so thought that would be a good topic today. We'll say before jumping into it, at the institutions, the pre-release, the reentry classes, every institution should be offering a class that is basically release procedures. That's going to go through, you know, this should be the specifics of what their institution does. You know, for example, at my last facility, if you were getting picked up for furlough transfer to a halfway house, or you were getting picked up for release, we released you at 8 a.m. Why 8 a.m.? Because shift change was at 7:30, and by 8 o'clock, the lobby was empty again. So that was how we did it. Now, if you were going by bus transportation, well, that depended on, you know, the bus schedule, obviously. But every institution is going to have some nuances to think about. So having said that, we will be kind of tackling it from just kind of a policy standpoint. So I thought the first thing talk about is public law releases. And we do have this come up, and we've had this impact some people that we work with in terms of home confinement, and thought we would kind of tackle that. So by law, if someone's release date falls on a weekend or a federal holiday, the Bureau is legally allowed to release them on the immediately preceding workday. So if your release date is on Saturday, they're going to release you on Friday. If it's Sunday, going to release you on Friday. If it's Labor Day weekend and Monday's a holiday, they're going to release you on the Friday. Kind of a little bit of a, and Bruce knows this from our years in federal service, every once in a while, depending on where Christmas falls, the president will give us an extra holiday. And so, you know, Christmas falls on a Thursday, we might get the Friday after Christmas. Or Christmas falls on a Tuesday and they give us Monday, right? Rather than have us have the time off, so we get a little bit more days. Well, guess what? When that happens, and oftentimes folks don't know until the week before, unit secretaries across the agency are redoing paperwork, because any of those folks that were scheduled to release on Friday, December 26th, and it was not a holiday.
That's what it is this year.
That's what it is this year. So who knows? After the stuff that the folks have been put through in federal service, as far as this shutdown, maybe they'll be a little kind and give them a holiday. But should that happen, anyone who was scheduled to release because their release date fell on December 26th, secretaries across the agency will be scrambling to redo release paperwork to allow them to release. In that case, the preceding workday would be December 24th, Christmas Eve. So that's what, when they talk about a public law release. Now, what if that home confinement eligibility falls on Saturday? Doesn't apply. Home confinement eligibility is a statutory eligibility date. And if it falls on the weekend, the Bureau doesn't have the legal authority to release you the day before. Now, to home confinement, transfer you from halfway house to home confinement. Now, has it happened out there? Possibly. But there's no one to complain about it. So,
yeah,
it happened, it happened. Unfortunately, what should be happening is if it falls on that Saturday or Sunday or a holiday, they, the earliest date they could be released would then be Monday. And it's not a release, I should say, it's a transfer. The earliest day they could transfer from halfway house to home confinement would be on the Monday after. So public law doesn't apply to anything other than actual release. So things to think about as your release date is approaching. One of the things, release clothing. The Bureau will provide, statutorily, the Bureau is required to provide release clothing for an individual. As a case management coordinator, it was my job to maintain a supply of assorted sizes of shirts, pants, socks.
As a coats. CMC?
It was my budget. I was responsible for ensuring release clothing. Yeah, it was part of my release budget. It was the same budget I used for bus tickets and gratuity and meals. And that included lightweight jackets and winter coats. Okay. So if someone doesn't have the ability to have release clothing sent in, clothing is provided. They're not going to send you home in your prison uniform. If family is able to, the earliest they can do that is 30 days ahead of time. And what happens is the individual, the loved one in custody, is going to have to get with their correctional counselor, is going to get a property request form, going to fill that out, get it signed off. They're going to mail it home. Mm-hmm. Counselor keeps a copy that goes to the central file. Copy goes to the mailroom. Copy goes home. Copy that goes home goes into the box. Now, as you and I have seen just recently, we have seen some halfway house dates change. I think last week that was the question, is could, you know, could someone who has a date get it advanced? We've seen it this week. But what that means is someone who was over a month from being eligible or for their transfer date, say December 17th, 18th, 19th. So they were outside 30 days, right? Now has a November date, they are inside 30 days. It is totally appropriate for for your loved one to go to his correctional counselor, get that form, get it signed, get it sent out so that it can go out to the family in advance of the 30 days. Family can't send it in until it's within 30 days. So doing that ahead of time, being prepared, so that in the event that a release date, a halfway house date happens quickly, you know, release dates, you know when your release date is. If you're releasing and not going to halfway house, you've got, it's set. I mean, short of, you know, misconduct or something weird happening. But for halfway house transfers, with some of the changes that have been going on, there's been a lot of flux in the agency going on, doing that paperwork ahead of time, sending it to the family so that if a date changes, that box can be sealed up and taken to the post office that day. It's also important when filling out that paperwork that the person who's filling it out is really specific, right? You know what size. I need a size 32, 34 pair of blue jeans. Don't put a brand on it. Just put blue jeans. And when your family sends in a pair of blue jeans, they send in blue jeans and they don't send in Dockers. Now, if you want to be really generic and you want to say one pair of pants, well, then you might be okay whether Dockers or jeans show up. But if you don't put a jacket on there and your family puts in a jacket, you're not going to get the jacket. It has to be exactly what's on that list. So that's super important. So personal property. Another thing folks don't necessarily think about is something called advance pay. If I know that my transfer date to Halfway House is going to be November 17th, I need to talk to my work detail supervisor because my work detail supervisor may or may not know. Now, if you have a super awesome on the ball unit secretary, they might shoot an email to that department to say, hey, Mr. Jones is leaving on the 17th. Yeah. Do advance pay. That requires like super awesome, angelic level up for sainthood unit secretary. Why? Because the secretaries have got a lot of work to do. And unfortunately, they're redoing work. For instance, when someone's furlough transfer paperwork that they were all done with has to change because their release, their transfer date has changed. So when you know you're leaving, you go to your supervisor and say, hey, I am transferring to Halfway House. Can you do my advance pay? And if any work detail supervisor out there says, well, I don't know what you're talking about, go talk to the case management coordinator. Advance pay is easy to do. They just need to know the date that the person would be leaving. You know, they'll calculate, okay, this is when he's scheduled to work. Okay, he's going to have accumulated 70 hours between the first.
It's going to be front loaded.
It's going to be front.
Woo!
Don't make me laugh.
Yeah, I get you. You hear that term front loaded a lot. Is it front loaded? What y'all front loaded?
Front load it.
Big money.
So,
all right.
When it comes to your advance pay, hence the word, it's advance. Now, what happens if your supervisor doesn't do the advance pay? Do you get that little, that half a month's pay? Yes, you will. But you're not going to get it until a while after your release because pay is not going to be processed until the end of the month by the supervisors. By policy, the case management coordinators have to the 10th of the month to get the pay processed. By that time, because you left on the 17th, you've been gone almost a whole month. You're in Halfway House.
Are they mailing it to his house or the Halfway House?
They're going to send it to whatever release residence he establishes. Because that will be what's
house.
In the system to the house.
Okay.
And
all
so,
right.
You know, now how long does it take? So once the pay is posted and now we know what it is, now they have to turn around and they have to request a check from the Treasury. How long do you think that's going to take? And that's without a shutdown. Before the Treasury sends back that check so that it can be mailed home. Get advance pay done. I know performance pay isn't that much unless you're like grade one. You know, if you're sitting there doing grade three or grade four, I know it's not that much, but it's the money that the person has earned and they are entitled to, and they should get everything they're entitled to. So advance pay, really important. Doesn't take much to process. They just need to get their supervisor and let them know. And then the trust fund folks will process it and that you will get that money when you're leaving. So in terms of the money that's in the accounts, so what accounts do the folks have? You've got your regular trust fund account. You got your TrueLinx account. If you have set up a pre-release fund account, right? You have all three of these accounts. Just prior to transferring out of the institution or releasing from custody, all of that money is put back into the one account. And what most folks are getting today, these days, is a release card, a debit card that's loaded with the money that's on there. Now, the good part about the debit, getting this card, is let's say you didn't do your advance pay. They can actually, once that pay is processed, they can actually transfer it to you via that card
as opposed
to the Treasury. But in the event, for whatever reason, they're not able to give you a release card that you would use like a check card or debit card, they will give you cash that's from your account. Depending on, A, the maximum is $500. So if you have a lot of money sitting in your account, you're not going to get it all. It will be sent to you via check later. Or if locally, now max $500 by policy, that doesn't necessarily mean the institution will have that much on hand to give you. So what do they give you in cash? Let's set your trust fund account aside for a second. You're going to get gratuity. You are going to get transportation money. Now, if you're going by bus, we always set up a bus ticket at my facility. But if you needed cab fare to get you from the Greyhound bus station to the halfway house, right, you had cab fare. Also gave you money for meals en route. Now, I don't know how generous folks are today because it's been a while since I've done it. But I literally looked at the bus schedule and was like, when are you leaving? And I used the institution's mainline schedule.
Per diem rate?
No, it's a mainline schedule. So if you were leaving at 5:30 in the morning, then you and you were arriving at 2 o'clock in the afternoon, okay, well, then you got lunch and you got breakfast because you left before the breakfast meal opened. But if you were leaving at 9:30 and were arriving by 2, you got lunch. That's it. If you were arriving at 4 o'clock in the afternoon, you didn't get dinner because mainline doesn't start until 5:30 or 5 o'clock. I used whatever our institution. I treated the gratuity money as if it was my own account and was, and I'm a frugal person. So if you were to miss a meal in the institution, then you got an amount for to get some food. Was it going to be a sit down meal at a restaurant? No. You know, it was going to be McDonald's,
yeah,
Burger King, Taco Bell. It was going to be something. It was just enough to keep you from starving en route. So because the Bureau is required to provide transportation. Now, there was a question about the how, bus, airline, et cetera. Some of this, what I'm going to say, is actually going to vary a little from institution to institution. Some institutions will fly a person if the bus transportation is more than X number of hours, whatever X number of hours are. I can tell you, as a case management coordinator, my wardens didn't feel that way. You went on the cheapest method of transportation, and I will say this was a while ago, so.
So did you ever? So did you ever do that on a 3-day bus trip and give the guy
100%
three squares?
100%. I put a guy on a Greyhound bus from Lee County, Virginia to Los Angeles, California. And yes, I counted how many meals he missed and I added it up because my wardens weren't going to let me fly somebody. Okay.
Yep.
You have to remember, well, you don't have to remember, but I started as a CMC in 2001. And then of course, 9/11 happened and transportation via air travel became a challenge.
That's true.
It was very difficult to, there weren't agreements the Bureau didn't have. Like today, they have a release ID that is a government issued release ID. Later in my time, I was there from 2001 to 2012. And later, if somebody was flying direct, from the local airport to wherever, and they didn't necessarily have to have a flight change, my local TSA administrator would accept the standard inmate issue ID with a copy of their notice of release and arrival or their furlough transfer paperwork. Like literally, I would send it. I would scan and send it over to his office so they knew they were flying and that it was legitimate. But if they were going to change, if they had to not have to be ID'd again. So they were leaving, you know, if there was anything, like if I was going to have them change airlines. And so they were going to have to go through security again. It didn't work. The only time we consistently flew individuals was if they had to go over water. So a release to Puerto Rico, a release to Guam, a release to Hawaii. But even then, to minimize the, because again, it was so hard flying people post 9/11, especially in those first several years, I would actually arrange for a institution transfer from Lee to Los Angeles Metropolitan Detention Center, and then would have them leave from LA, from the MDC in LA, to go to Hawaii. Oh, I lost your sound. You just muted out. Oh, there you are. Oh, no, you're gone.
Did that, or you just you?
Oh, go ahead. Go ahead. I got you now.
Am I here?
Yeah, you're there.
Who did the flight? LA staff,
the Marshals.
Or you did the flight?
I literally got a redesignation.
No. From LA to their home.
Oh, then they would go by commercial air from their home.
Right, but who booked that? Who booked that?
Oh, I did. I mean, my institution did. We had to arrange all of the transportation. Yeah, so the Bureau is required to arrange for transportation all the way home. So even if I was doing something like I'm transferring you, I even did.
Was that a holdover? Were they holding over then in LA?
Yeah.
Okay.
Not really a holdover.
A furlough?
I would do a near release transfer.
Transfer.
With a release residency management variable sometimes. I did some crazy stuff. It worked. But I would call the CMC at the other institution and say, hey, I've got a dude going to Guam. And then when Hawaii opened, I would fly them. It was harder because, you know, Marshall flights only run twice a year. But if I could time it, I had actually transferred some people to Hawaii. And then it was only a little puddle jump, not a puddle jumper, but you know what I mean? It was only a hop to Guam. Or if they were from Hawaii proper and I'd gotten them a halfway house, there's not a halfway house in Hawaii anymore. When there was, I would get them their halfway house designation on the Big Island, and then we would fly them to Hawaii on a near release transfer.
Were the people in LA pissed at you? Or
No. I would coordinate it ahead of time. I would call them and say, "Hey, I got this dude. You know, he's got a halfway house in Hawaii, and so." Or he's got a place to be released residency. See, the problem was, is I was on the East Coast. So this is God's honest true story. You know that Tom Hanks movie about getting trapped in the airport? So from the East Coast, if I was going to fly somebody to Guam, because that was their release residence, from the East Coast of the U.S., you connect through Japan. And they don't have passports. So in order to book a flight from the East Coast, from Virginia, to get them to Guam by way of going west and not east, I would have to book them from Virginia to California to Hawaii to Guam. And it was like a $3,000 or $4,000 airline ticket. So, which was very expensive. And did I mention I'm pretty frugal? So yeah, so I would pick up the phone and I would call like NBC LA, or when they were in Hawaii, I would call Hawaii and I'd talk to the CMC and I'd be like, hey, this is the dude I got. Can you talk to your AW warden? Blah, 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 blah. They'd send me an email saying, yeah, we're good with it. And then I'd send all of that to designation to get them moved. Did the same thing with Puerto Rico, with Guam, with Guantanamo. Yeah. I did what I could to save money.
We had to do it. We did a TDAT contract one time in Saipan.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, Guam and then Saipan. And then those guys in the Western region got to go on audits. That was good for them. Anyway.
There you go. So
there you go.
When it comes to whether or not you get to fly on the government expense, it's going to be that local institution's call. Like I said, my warden, unless they were going over water, didn't approve those.
Hey, I think we had a guy go from Cumberlandish to Charlotteish on a flight here recently.
Again, locally, if the warden says the drive time is too much, right? The warden can say, "Well, no, that would take, you know, more than 8 hours, so I'm going to fly them." That is the warden's call. Okay, if a family member wants to pay for that flight, they 100% can. But if the government, the rule is that the government is supposed to kind of balance vote that expense of what it's going to cost against the security concerns in terms of the length of the distance. But like I said, today I think wardens are a little more conservative with that. It's also easier to fly people either transferring or releasing because of the government, those official government IDs. Like I said, yeah. Back when I was doing it, if you didn't have an active driver's license or a passport, like
inmate ID,
you had your little red and white inmate ID.
Yeah.
And that was it, you know, and I would make sure it was new and clean and crisp and it was your current picture. You know, I had my guys in R&D retake pictures and, it would have your date. We could put it like we had two options. One was like just your name and your register number and your height and your weight. And then we had another one that was like your name, your register, your height, your weight, and your date of birth. So we would do the other ones to get it as close to an ID as possible. But yeah, those first several years after 9/11 were really challenging. So in terms of transportation.
Right.
So release, transportation, gratuity there's transportation and meals, and then there's gratuity. And gratuity is money above and beyond that is just supposed to help. Now, by policy, a person can get up to $500. In the 11 years that I was a case management coordinator, as well as the 10 years that I was a case manager, I never saw anyone get $500. I had one person receive $300, and nice. He actually came to me and said, "Hey, Miss Giddings, I've got a job." And he had his letter from his employer, and it was a construction job, and he had to have certain, you know, he had to have his own tool belt, he had to have his own framing hammer, he had certain tools that he had to have. And he needed safety boots. And I can't remember, he had a list and it was from the employer sent it. And we had confirmed he had a job and he asked for funds to purchase the tools that he needed. And it wasn't a lot. It was like a framing hammer. And I know there was a square, one of those, you know, right angle things. And maybe a tape measure. I know there was a tool belt in there. I can't remember what else was in there. It was a few things. But he went so far as to have his family send like the circular, you know, when you get the Lowe's, Home Depot, sent the circular, did their research and sent in the clippings to show what the price was of these things. So my warden was on board with that, you know, getting those funds. And then we authorized him to take a pair of work boots from the institution. And we also authorized him to take two sets of the uniform, which of course looked like work clothes. And we just didn't put any of, you know, we didn't put the name tags on them. So they were just a pair of work pants and a pair of shirt and a shirt. But he did his homework. You know, I would have folks send me requesting $500 gratuity to include for security deposit and rent and utility deposits. And I'm like, you're going to halfway house, get a job. That's what that's for. I was kind of mean with gratuity. There is, if you are a non-US citizen releasing to immigration, you have to have at least $10. So if you have less than $10 in your account, they will give you money up to $10. So, you know, like you have $8.50 in your account, they're going to give you $8.50 plus the dollar and a half to bring it up to 10. That $500 limit on the cash that we talked about, not the gratuity, but the cash in your account, that doesn't apply to immigration cases. The deportation cases is they get all of the money that's in their account. They could get it in cash. And for those who might be sitting in pretrial detention and then are released, maybe they're bonded out, maybe the case is dismissed, any money in their accounts is given to them in cash as well. So that's something else there. So that covers gratuity and transportation. Already talked about in terms of pickup times, again, varies from institution to institution. What's going to happen is the unit secretary going to call you into the office. Hey, doing your transportation, doing that furlough transfer, doing your release paperwork. Is your family picking you up or am I providing transportation? Be prepared for that answer. Okay. I would even go so far as to say, if you are someone who has action in the court and there is, and you, not because you're being overly helpful, but you believe I'm looking at a sentence reduction. There is, you know, there's been a guideline change. And when this goes in effect and the court rules, I'm going to be in immediate release. I would be having that transportation conversation with my family in advance, because in the situation of an immediate release or a very short release, you're making decisions immediately. Again, another story. I remember getting an immediate release. I happened to be duty officer that weekend, and I was on the phone with the family trying to figure out what was the closest bus station, because they were out in the middle of nowhere. They weren't near an airport either. So I was trying to find out the closest bus transportation, the bus station of where the family could meet him to get him and I could release him. And we ended up from Lee County, Virginia. We ended up driving him up to Lexington, Kentucky, if I recall correctly, to put him on a bus in Lexington, because our little local bus station like had one outbound bus a day going east and one outbound going west.
Now, y'all had a staff member do that. You didn't have a town driver go up there, did you?
No, not that far. But we did have town drivers. Like from where I was located, you could take, you might take a bus out of Kingsport, Tennessee, because we were there. But you could also have take a bus out of Knoxville, Tennessee, or going the other way, like over toward like Hazard, Kentucky, because we were kind of in that point. And town, and we did have town drivers take folks. That particular one, we did end up having a staff member because it was going a good 3 hours out. It was about 3 hours, 2.5, 3 hours away from the institution. But, you know, have those conversations. Be ready, because, you know, when something good happens, you know, we really as Bureau employees, I'm not a we anymore. They really do work to get you out as fast as possible. But if you're in a situation, one of these remote areas, in the case of where I was, there was one bus that went out at 6 a.m. that went east and one bus at like 8:30 that went west. And if you weren't going in one of those two directions, you were waiting to the next morning. So, you know, and yeah, we could have put the guy up in a hotel overnight and he wouldn't have left to the next morning. But obviously you get released, you want to go home. So I was, like I said, I was on the phone with family at 5 o'clock in the afternoon saying, okay, give me the, what are the closest bus stations to you situation? So always important to be prepared. So what else do we have? Talked about meals, transportation. So let's talk about some medical issues. For folks who receive chronic care medication, blood pressure medicine, diabetes medicine, high blood pressure, those kind of things, you got a regular prescription. When you transfer to Halfway House, and I've got the policy note in front of me because I highlighted it. When you're transferring to Halfway House, they're providing you, the institution is to provide you with a 90-day supply. That's to give you some leeway, some lead time for your next prescription. When you release, the policy says 30 to 90 days from the institution. So if you're just straight up releasing 30 to 90 days, again, chronic care medication, they're not going to give you a 90-day supply of Tylenol, OTCs, vitamins, those kind of things. If you have your own and you've bought them out of the commissary, whatever, that's on you. But those chronic care medications that you need to have, they're going to provide. Now, I can tell you, there is a piece of paper. When transfer paperwork is being done, it goes through medical to put medical on notice so that they can go ahead and they can pull that subscription together. And then they can have prescription, sorry, that prescription together, and they can have it over in R&D waiting for your pickup. And in a perfect world, nice. Everything happens perfectly. If you show up at R&D the day before, because you're packing out the day before, and you know you get blood pressure medicine, self-advocate. Hey, has medical sent over my blood pressure medicine yet? I know I'm supposed to get a 90-day supply when I go to Halfway House. I think it's really, I mean, you and I talk about last week's show was on self-advocacy. This is another one of those things. Mm-hmm. You got to ask the question. If you know when you checked yourself in, you brought your driver's license, your birth certificate with you. And you know, because you talked to your case manager, you saw your inmate central file, and it's in the inmate central file. When you're at R&D the day before packing out, because that's when they do that, and you're packing and inventorying your property, you ask the R&D officer, hey, did the unit team send over my driver's license and birth certificate? Because again, in a perfect world, it should already be there. But do we live in a perfect world? Things happen. If you know you came in with your driver's license, you need to leave with your driver's license, birth certificate, passport, whatever documents, personal identification documents. Ask the question. You will pack out your stuff. Let's talk about how much property you take home. You're not getting a suitcase. You are going to carry your own property. Be that in a mesh bag, be that in a box, you are going to carry it. So again, preparing for release, you can start sending your personal effects home before your release. Do you really want your photo album, your heavy photo album? Do you really want all of your legal paper? And paper is heavy. Do you really want to carry that? Think about that commissary you have that you've had in your locker. Like, start dwindling down your supply. You know, I'm not saying give it away, but you're carrying it or you're throwing it away. Think about what you're going to do with it. Plan for your release. Any thoughts about commissary, Bruce?
No, I've just seen guys give away their commissary and then some snafu happened and then they were kind of SOL. You know what I mean? Giving all their stuff away. It's like,
happen. It can happen. I'm not saying give it away 3 months ahead of time.
Right.
But maybe kind of start.
Absolutely not.
Start titrating down the amount of stuff you're buying and use up your stuff.
Yeah.
If it's legal work, if it's personal stuff, send that home early because you're carrying it other ways. Okay. So, and usually, like I said, you're put on call out the day before you're leaving. If you're leaving on a Monday, they're probably packing you out on Friday. And you're going to carry all your stuff over to R&D. It's going to be inventoried. It's going to be packed out. And you've got to decide what you're keeping and carrying and what, you know, and you can make that decision to ship stuff home right there. My thought is start earlier. And if you're waiting to the very end, make sure you got plenty of money in your commissary so you can get those postage stamps because you will pay for your own postage at home.
Oh.
Yeah.
That's a good point.
All right. So is there anything else? Got to watch my time. Sometimes I rattle too long. Talked about the release cards, talked about the ID cards. The Bureau is, The personal ID cards, that's something that's newer. That was something that was actually started rolling out within the last 2 years. A little less than that, I think, actually. They had started it while right toward the tail end of when I was still working. That is a legal government ID. My recommendation, again, don't wait until a month before your release. Now, the process is pretty quick, and the government printing office that ships IDs does work pretty quickly. But talk to your case manager about it. Talk to the reentry affairs person at your institution. Hey, I just wanted to touch base with you. I'm leaving for halfway house in January. I'm going to need an ID. What do I need to do? Chances are you're already on the list and they know about you. But if your date just changed, if you were releasing in December and now you're releasing at the end of November, I'd be talking to that reentry officer immediately. And again, the case manager, the unit secretary may have already picked up the phone and called down the reentry officer and said, hey, you know, I'm going to need that ID 3 weeks early. He's now leaving here. But don't count on that. And that's the most important thing I can say. In a perfect world, everything runs smoothly. We're not in a perfect world. Things happen. So kind of paying attention to that. But the release ID is really a good thing. Talked about the release cards. Want to talk about one more medical issue to talk about is folks with medical or mental health needs that are care 3 or care 4. Those folks, in some cases, you know, they're transferring to a medical facility. I know when we were at Carswell, some of our social workers were phenomenal. And they weren't going to a halfway house. They were, or, you know, they, because nursing of their home. Medical needs, yeah. They were going to a nursing home. They were going mm-hmm. to a group home in the case of mm-hmm. some mental health needs. Those social workers are phenomenal. But if we have one case manager for, you know, every 150, 170, inmates in the system, you may have an institution that has two social workers, or they may not have any social workers, but they have a regional social worker they depend on. And that regional social worker might cover three care three facilities. So, you know, talking to, again, case management, setting up a conversation with the social worker assigned to the institution. I'm less concerned for the medical facilities because they are very accompanied.
They're all over it.
Right. They, you know, heck, when I was at Carswell, the social worker assigned to the chronic care unit there, literally we shared a door. We had adjoining offices and the door was usually open. So I could just like yell from my desk or she'd yell from her desk because we were literally just through the doorway. But the care three facility, the care three folks, they are sitting in general population institutions. They probably do not have a social worker. Locally, they have a social worker that is assigned. They have a regional mass team social worker. And in those cases, they should be with those folks with care three and care four, the social workers are working on those continuity of care plans 3 months ahead of time. So again, planning for your release, and it may all be taken care of. And, you know, as an individual, you know, you're touching base with your case manager or you touch base with a social worker and it's all good. And like I said, for folks in medical centers, not an issue. This is, excuse me, as you said, they're all over it. But when you're talking about, excuse me, when you're talking about a care three population, mm-hmm. and a regional social worker, and that regional social worker may be assigned two or three different institutions, asking those questions is important.
Right.
Trying to think if there's anything. I know we're almost out of time.
Kind of underscores why case management and folks need to get these transition to the community dates established in a timely manner. So
100%.
All this pre-release training and pre-release preparation, if you will, like you said, medicine, property, release gratuity, airplane ticket, bus ticket, or how that's going to go down. So
all that coordination.
All that coordination. So the timely the timeliness of that, you know, transition to the community date.
And with the new resources, with the conditional placement date and the maximum home confinement eligibility date, having those, that information now readily available on the worksheets is a fantastic tool for the case managers. That was one thing that was lost, was that lead time to coordinate, to get this stuff coordinated with all of, with this new, with these new resources all in place now. There's, in my mind, there's no reason that case managers shouldn't be operating the way we always did. You know, I, you know, by policy, a referral list has to be submitted 60 days in advance of the placement date. I had one case that I recall where the unit team had made a recommendation and she didn't like her recommendation. It was a Carswell camper. And she didn't like the recommendation. And she was refusing to provide me her release information because she was still trying to convince the unit manager to give her a different, to give her a longer placement recommendation. And she didn't need it. But she wouldn't give me, she wouldn't give me her address for me to complete a progress report and her supervised release plan and stuff. And it was still submitted like 65 days from her expected. But I was usually doing referrals, like a late referral for me was being submitted 90, 100 days in advance of the requested date. I was usually doing my cases anywhere from 4 to 6 months out because I could, you know, because I had all the information I needed. That's what case managers lost over the last couple of years with FSA, is having those known dates, and now they have them. And that's from a caseload management perspective. Yeah. That's fantastic.
That's because, you know,
great resource.
There's really, And you're not surprised with it. There's no surprise changes or whatever per se. I mean, you're going to have that to some degree with certain things that happen.
Absolutely. But, I mean, things happen. And, but, even if a date changes, if you are prepared, like we have a client, we have two clients, I think, who went from December dates to November dates this past week. They got their date advanced by 3-4 weeks. As long, but they knew their dates were in December, so they should be already having those conversations, right? Talking to family, talking this, you know, hey, I'm going by bus, I'm doing this, I'm not doing this. You know, those are the conversations they have. So even though there's a change and now it's a shorter window, they're already starting. That's some of the things that we talk to our clients about is, okay, you know, be prepared. Be thinking about what your transportation is going to be.
All right. We're at 2 minutes. Awesome.
No, we are.
Awesome. See, where did the time go? Where did it go? You know? It's just amazing stuff here, but I'm glad that we talked about these release procedures today. You're going to want to refer to this. Is this going to be a keeper episode for some of you short timers out there or whatever coming through, and especially the family members looking at this, helping their loved ones get prepared for that wonderful day that they get released from custody. So you'll want to know this stuff. And again, if you have any questions, feel free to email us or have a pose a question on the Facebook group or attach a comment to this video once it's on YouTube, twice with LA Talk Radio, and then again on our YouTube channel. So that's awesome. And so, yeah. And again, don't forget for the holidays, buy our blue book that is over there for the First Step Act.
I had a second edition.
Something on that. And the second edition. And if you're early in the process, the green book on classification. Got to get those and stay ready. You can see the show here on Apple Podcast, Amazon Audible, on LA Talk Radio, and several other podcast aggregators, and our Facebook group and YouTube. So we're easy to access. So, all right, everybody. Well, stay warm, stay safe, and we'll see everybody here next time on Around the Block. Take care, everybody. See you. Have a good week.
Bye-bye.
You're listening to Federal Prison Authority Presents Around the Block with Bruce Cameron and Susan Giddings, only on LA Talk Radio.